so much for tuning in to Hashtag No Limits. Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For anyone who doesn't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into cells, reforms into the butterfly. And if that wasn't enough struggle, it then has to continue to struggle in order for its wings to be strong enough to fly once it comes out of the cocoon. And if we help it too much or at all along that way, it's not going to have what it needs in order to be the best butterfly that it could be. And we may actually do damage to it. While we want to help anyone who struggles, we have to be careful that we don't overhelp. And I've never said that before. I'm not really sure why that was prompted in my brain today, but I don't really think it goes along with what we're going to talk about. But today I have someone who has two children with autism, and he is working in law enforcement. And I'm really thrilled to learn about him, learn more about him, and to share him with you. His name is Stefan Bies, and he is going to enlighten us about law enforcement and working with people, interacting with people with disabilities, specifically autism. So, Stefan, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I am great, Shelley. It is a great pleasure to be on with you today. So thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. So Stefan and I were introduced to each other a few months back. He did a presentation for a family organization that I happen to be involved in. And as soon as I heard him speak and heard about his program, I was like, okay, I've got to get this guy on because what he's doing is so amazing. So Stefan, tell us a little bit about your background. Like I mentioned your children who have autism. So if you want to start with your kids or your company, either way.
I recently retired from law enforcement. I spent 21 years in law enforcement. I retired as a patrol sergeant. But I also have two sons with autism. You know, my sons were diagnosed about 10 years ago. And as my wife and I took in this life-altering diagnosis for our sons and wondered what their future would hold, we set out to learn as much about autism and the disabilities we possibly could so that we could be the best advocates for our sons as they grew older. And as I learned more about the disability, I began to wonder, what would happen if my two worlds collided, meaning my professional life as law enforcement and my personal life as a father of two sons with autism? So I set out to find out what we knew as law enforcement about autism and interacting with people with disabilities. And the truth is, we didn't know anything. We knew very, very little. There was little to no training out there about how to have the characteristics and behaviors associated with particular disabilities. So I put a program together for my own department where I worked because I wanted my officers to understand my son's disability. Mm-hmm. And another department reached out, and then another department reached out, and then another department reached out. And I'm at about 4,000 first responders later. I'm still traveling all over teaching law enforcement and any first responder for that matter. So we're talking police, fire, EMS, and now police dispatchers as well. What to expect when you're interacting with somebody who has specifically autism, because that's where my background is at. And it's been the receptive departments have been really receptive about it, but there's some that are not. And that's, you know, my goal moving forward is I want to be able to get this training out nationwide because as good as we're doing as law enforcement, there's still a lot of failures. I just received a call back in October from an attorney who was representing a family, and they had a 16-year-old son with autism who's nonverbal, was leaving a laser tag facility, and was just completely overwhelmed. It was sensory overload, like laser tag lights, all that.
Sure.
For all of us parents of a child with autism, we understand that. And he became aggressive with his father. Law enforcement was contacted. They restrained him on the ground in handcuffs for 9 minutes, and he died as a result of that interaction. And the attorney that I was speaking with was representing the family in the civil suit, the wrongful death. And an agreement had been made, but part of that agreement was to train this department because they had never received any training. So as advanced as we are, we're still way behind where we should be in law enforcement training. So that is my ultimate goal. And there are some amazing organizations out there that I've worked with to be able to get this message out. But, you know, Florida is one of those great states that's coming online right now. Is there's some legislation right now in Florida that's saying that all law enforcement will be mandated to have training relating to autism and intellectual and developmental disabilities, which is wonderful.
Wow, yeah. But
they're one of the few states in the country that actually have this. So, you know, short term, it was training the local departments around my area, but long term is getting this training out to all first responder agencies across the country. And there's a handful of great instructors out there, but there's just nearly not enough. And the demand is growing, and that's really become my passion. Even though I'm retired, I still work full time. This is my second job, as you would say it, but I love doing it. And I'm still, I get out 2 to 3 times a month training law enforcement, particularly here in Illinois. I've trained, I don't know how many just in Illinois. So that's really my passion. That's why I did it. It's my motivation with my boys. And I leave every presentation with the same statement, like maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but somebody in this class is going to interact with one of my two sons. I want to make sure they have the best resources and training available so that interaction is positive for my sons, but also for them as the law enforcement officer as well. And that's, I leave every presentation with that. And that is my mission moving forward.
Yeah. And I'm really excited because I've been working with some of my local law enforcement people, and we're going to try to get you to Southern Illinois where I am. And I'm not really sure where that is in the works yet. I know they had reached out and I don't know exactly where it is, but so I'm really excited to bring you down to the southern part of the state. And I think that what you're doing is so incredibly valuable and important. And I hope that we can get all of the first responders and the dispatchers and everyone trained. But tell me about the difficulty in that. I mean, you know, most of us are not police officers. We're not fire protection people. We're not emergency response people. You know, so a lot of our ideas about those types of positions are what we see in movies and television. And so if you can explain, without really degrading any particular show, kind of the differences between reality, or if there are similarities between reality and some of the shows on television or, you know, in the movies.
There are some similarities. It's most of the time it's pretty far-fetched. You know, coming from a law enforcement background, vast majority of our shifts were spent busy, but just responding to call, to call, to call. What you see on TV shows and things like that doesn't really exist. Those moments happen, but it's an easiest way to describe a law enforcement career is it's 7.5 hours of boredom surrounded by, you know, 5 minutes of sheer terror. And sometimes it's the way it would go is right. We have nothing going in a 12-hour shift. And then suddenly the last 6 minutes of your shift would be the utmost, most terrifying thing you've ever experienced. And that's what it is. And I think part of the profession is also it's unpredictable. Mm-hmm. You never quite know what you're going to walk into or what you're interacting with and who's suffering from what or going through what or a lot of different things. So it's a lot of law enforcement is the unknown, is you never quite know what you're going into. And I think that relays right in my training is for a law enforcement perspective, we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
That's the biggest thing. And if we don't have any idea of how interacting with these people with disabilities or individuals with disabilities is going to go, then we result to the training that we've had for 20 plus years, 2 decades. We've learned in the police academy because we don't know how to interact another or act in another way. And that's, I think that's one of the biggest things that we're seeing is we're trained a certain way in the police academy through your field training and even throughout your career of things to look out for and things that should raise suspicions and things like that. But when you see those things, they're also the same characteristics that somebody with a disability may display. Mm-hmm. So it's a lack of understanding or misinterpretation of those characteristics. So like specifically if you're dealing with somebody who's autism, who's nonverbal, right? We know that a significant portion of our autism population is limited to no verbal ability and they're not interacting with you, are red flags as law enforcement go up and be like, what are they hiding? Why are they being deceitful? Are they being aggressive? And it's just a myth of the lack of understanding. So that's really my goal is saying, yes, you may have somebody that's displaying those characteristics. And it may be somebody who is just refusing to cooperate with you. but taking into consideration it could be a disability as well. So I'm teaching law enforcement of other things to look for beyond what the surface says. You know, are you seeing stimming? Are you seeing some echolalia? Are you seeing some scripting? Are you seeing a reduction in lack of eye contact? And these are all things that should send up some of our red flags from a law enforcement perspective. Like, wait a minute, time out. Let's rethink this. Maybe this is somebody with a disability, and being able to pick up on those characteristics and then shifting your tactics of how you're going to handle that interaction. And there's a few videos that I use in my training when I'm training law enforcement. There's another great video out of Buckeye, Arizona. He's a 15-year-old boy, and he's wandering around a park. And his caregiver goes to a music lesson, and his routine is that he walks around the park, and he's stimming with a piece of string. It draws the officer's attention. The officer interacts with him. The officer interprets his behaviors as being under the influence. It's not. It's a stimming-related behavior.
Right.
So the officer goes to, in essence, do a pat-down search or search of this young man, and he immediately reacts. It's that fight-or-flight response. Mm-hmm. And as we kind of pick apart the video, and I said, there's some giant red flags that I see from my perspective that the officer could have picked up on, where he could have said, wait a minute, this isn't somebody who's under an influence. It's a young man who has a disability, specifically autism. The officer doesn't know or doesn't pick these things up. And actually, after the interaction, kind of the officer ends up going hands-on. There's a struggle on the ground. And the young man who's 15 suffers some injuries during the interaction. When his caregiver does walk up, the officer says to her during the interaction, she's like, he's doing something with his hands. And she goes, yeah, he's stimming. And he says, I don't know what that is. And that's a huge problem. That's right. Stimming is one of those characteristics that we have to be able to pick up on. But again, the officer has never been trained or has never been able to pick up on these cues that he's displaying. And in that interaction, there's deficits in his tone of voice. He's stimming. There's some scripting. These are all red flags that the young man displays during the initial interaction that the officer misses. And that's what we're trying to do. But we're never taught that, to see it from a different perspective. We're taught that
right. These
things are somebody under the influence, a mental health crisis, somebody who isn't cooperative or being evasive. And it's not the case. Not always the case. Sometimes it is the case.
Sure.
But it's not. So, and again, this is why this training is so important. And I'm not talking like, I watched a webinar one time 3 years ago and I checked the box. That's not what we're talking about. Is I use my own experiences of my own two sons and experiences from across the country so that officers understand, like, these are the things that somebody with a disability will display. I think that's the critical portion of it. I'm taking real life examples from my own personal life and other incidents across the country, picking them apart and learning things. And there's nothing more rewarding than having a department call out and be like, we had an interaction like 3 days after we did your training and it was successful. And like, one of the strategies that we utilize is sensory kits. Mm-hmm. We know that a lot of times our meltdowns or our problem behavior is sensory related, right? It's mm-hmm. too loud, it's too light, it's too many people. Well, how do we do that? You're going to create calm down areas. And if you're in somebody's house, that's great. But if you're out in public, what do we have to do as law enforcement? I tell them, like, you have to create a calm down area, and it's done through preferred sensory needs. Noise canceling headphones, different fidgets, all sorts of things. And we built these kits to put in our squad cars. And my officers were like, we're going to put toys in the car now. And I'm like, trust me, wait and see how effective they really are. And working with a couple different organizations around the state of Illinois, we've been able to incorporate these kits in, I think, 15 to 20 different law enforcement agencies across the state. And I did one, it was about a year and a half ago, I did a training for a department. And within 3 days of incorporating their kits, they responded to a call of a 21-year-old adult with autism in a crisis, having a meltdown. And they utilized the kits, and it was no use of force, no ambulance ride. They were able to de-escalate. I'm like, that's a success story. And the deputy chief's like, they were so effective, and they've used them multiple times. And these are small things that we can do to provide, make sure these interactions are going well and not being misinterpreted, in different strategies that we utilize. And it's just one of the things we talk about when I'm dealing with this training. So those are small things, and it's why. But this is never taught to the officers in the academy. Now it is in Illinois. It is taught now. But even mandating laws in Illinois, it's officers are encouraged to get some additional training about autism or disabilities some point in their career, but it's not mandated yet.
Right.
So there are officers that have never had any training other than maybe basic academy. And depending on when they go, I went to the academy 2+ decades ago. They did not have this training for us.
Sure.
We went. So it's evolved, or at least it's now introduced in the academy.
Yeah. And so if you wouldn't mind, because I'm really hoping, I had invited several of my law enforcement friends to watch this episode. And so just little snippets of, you know, can you describe to them what echolalia is or what stimming is, so that if they're not getting training anywhere else, at least they'll have 2 minutes or so of this, you know, to give them a little bit more knowledge than what they might have had before.
Yeah, and stimming, echolalia, scripting are all characteristics you'll see related to a disability, specifically in autism, but in a wide range of disability as well. And echolalia is just repeating of the last phrase that they hear. So during a law enforcement interaction, you may approach and be like, let me have your ID. And they'll be like, okay, let me see your ID. What's your address? They'll be like, what's your address? Like, what's your phone number? Like, what's your phone number? And the officers may be like, all right, what's the deal here? Like, they're uncooperative. And it's not. They're just repeating back the last phrase that they hear. And it's a couple different reasons why we see that. Number one, it's the lack of communication. But number two, they're trying to bridge that gap of how to interpret the response and formulate their own response as well. We talk about this in communication. Scripting is just the repeating of books, phrases from books, movies, videos, whatever it might be. My boys script incessantly all day long. Like, they're consistently scripting. And when you hear scripting, you think they're not paying attention, but they absolutely are. My boys can script, play on an iPad, and still pick up on everything that's going on around them. I don't know how they do it, but they do. But we from a law enforcement perspective, we hear scripting and we think it's nonsense or babble, and it's not. Many times, or in some instances, what they're scripting isn't absolutely appropriate to the given situation, but we're not picking up on those cues. It's just because it's not specific to the interaction. But during an interaction, they'd be scripting a book, a video, a social story that they are recalling and trying to apply it to that given situation, but we're not picking up on those cues. And we miss where they're giving us the information that we need is from our perspective of law enforcement, but we're missing it because we don't understand what scripting is. We're not paying attention because we immediately think it's nonsense or babble, or they're just certain things like that. Stimming is just repetitive or restrictive behaviors. Stimming can manifest in a lot of different ways. So hand flapping, pacing, or rocking, repetitive blinking, humming. Stimming can be a lot of different things. There's an attachment to inanimate objects. So for my boys, when they go anywhere, we have like a kit. It just goes with us, right? It's a doodle board. It's whatever their preferred item is, it goes with us because that's just their security blanket from wherever we're going. But we're missing on those things. But from a law enforcement perspective, we see something in somebody's hands. We're like, let me see your hands. What's in your hand? There's an officer safety perspective. But I tell officers, I'm like, if their preferred interest or preferred item that they're attached to is a piece of string that's this big, is it really going to hurt us? The answer is no. If that preferred item is a chainsaw, changes the dynamics. And I say that because I know several kids that their preferred interest is small gas-powered engines. And a chainsaw would be their end-all, be-all Christmas gift of all time.
Right.
So it just depends on the situation. So use a lot of that common sense. Be like, it's a piece of string. It's not going to harm me. But removing that item can cause a problem behavior. So if it's not a harm to them or us, let them keep it. These are things we talk about. I talk about in the training and these, some of the characteristics you see, but I also include a disclaimer saying you may see some, all, or none of these characteristics, because there's that saying out there, if you know one person with autism, guess what? You know one person with autism.
Right.
So I'm like, you may see a variety or a severity that's different from person to person to person. My two boys have the same disability, but their characteristics are very different from each other. So I'll explain that. So we're talking about generalized characteristics. You may see some or all of these, not specific to that individual, and it may be different from person to person. So it's difficult because you have, from a law enforcement perspective, you have sometimes split seconds or a very narrow window to make an interpretation of what you're interacting with. So I tell officers, we want time and distance, right? Give ourselves additional time and give ourselves an additional distance because we can then process the information a little bit better, take in more information and formulate a better decision. And for my department, before I retired, and even now, I'm a defensive tactics instructor. So, but it's also part of that is determining what force is appropriate, what's not, right. And how to interpret some of those things and picking up on body language and cues and characteristics are an important aspect of it. But I always stress time and distance are what we want. And it's no different in these interactions as well.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that oftentimes officers do have to make split second decisions. But maybe in the majority of cases, or maybe not the majority, but in a lot of other cases, it isn't a split second decision. So they can take a breath in it, mm-hmm. as an example, and just go, okay, think about, and I'm sure I'm an educator by nature. And so, I've got so much training and I was a special educator. So I've learned lots of things over the years about lots of disabilities, but even all of the training that I've had and the intentional continued learning that I do, I can't remember every single thing that I have learned over the years. And I've been exposed to so much again and again and again, and yet I still forget sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I'm not in a potentially life and death situation like many police officers are in those moments. And so I feel like there's not as much physical training that you're doing, although I want to get to that, if there is some sort of different ways that you teach as far as the physical interaction and holding, but just the mental training of take that breath, stop for, a second if you can, and just think, can this be scenario A or could it be scenario B?
Yeah, it can. And I think, the big training that we're pushing throughout the state of Illinois, even nationwide, is CIT or crisis intervention training. And that's exactly what we're talking about, right? It's recognizing these characteristics of somebody with a disability, somebody with suffering a mental health crisis, so on and so forth. And there is some hands-on. There is a huge role play type, one whole day of just role playing and running officers through scenarios with these paid actors who are outstanding and playing this role, and they feed off of the officer's interactions. And that whole point of that training is to tell officers exactly what you're saying, right? Give ourselves a little bit of time, give ourselves a little bit of distance, be able to process some of this information a little bit quicker because you've been exposed to it in a controlled setting, not the first time you're interacting with somebody in a mental health crisis or with a disability is on an actual call for service, right? And that's what we're picking up on and creating that muscle memory and that frame of reference that we're talking about to kind of build that and picking up on some of those cues. But again, creating from a law enforcement perspective, I always tell our officers, create barriers in between you and an individual, whether it's a piece of furniture, a vehicle, right? We want to create that distance to give ourselves that ability to formulate a better decision and take in information. And the biggest thing I tell cops is slow things down. If you can slow it down, that's wonderful. And what we see in these interactions is that the officer reacts, the individual reacts, and now this thing is on this avalanche of things that are going on, and you're taking in too much information, you can't process it from both sides. So slow things down. If you can, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's impossible to do. And every interaction is going to have a script that you can follow. We know right. that. But again, if we can slow things down, create time and distance, and that's what we want to do to be able to process information, that is the ultimate goal. And I see a lot of interactions as we pick apart like different scenarios and things that are happening. Officers are rushing into certain things, right? They're rushing in, but it's not always necessary. But from our perspective, that adrenaline's pumping, you're trying to process information, and it's a balance. And a lot of it comes with maturity, training, and just experience. And it's a huge aspect of it. But I always tell officers, slow things down. Like, we rush into certain things, and it's just not we put ourselves in situations where now you're forced to make a split-second decision. It's not always the best situation to be in.
Yeah. And, I think about myself as an educator, and I had many students who had some pretty big behaviors that mm-hmm. seemed to be who ended up under my care the most, which was great. Those ended up being the kiddos that I loved the most. And I felt like a private investigator in a sense, because, you know, I was trying to figure out, well, what's causing this behavior? I always say that communication, our behavior is communication. So what's that communication right. behind that behavior? But I had time to investigate. I had days or weeks or months or years if I needed, you know, to really get to the bottom of that. But we can't expect our law enforcement officers to, or our fire protection people to take, I mean, they don't have that much time. It's just, it's not possible. So how often do you recommend that people go through these scenarios? Because they may, as you said, you know, at some point they're all going to come across someone who has some sort of a disability. But if they haven't had the training for 2 years or 3 years, they're probably not going to remember some of the tips and tricks. So how often do you recommend that they have these sort of refreshers or this full-fledged training?
And it sounds, it's going to sound awful, but it should be an annual basis. It really should be an annual basis. There are some certain training mandates in Illinois that training has to be done on an annual basis. Some of them require scenario-based training, use of force being one of them and having some scenario-based situations. But I think it's a great way to utilize that where, but nobody says those mandates have to be scenario-based, just a use of force situation. You can have a scenario built on de-escalation, crisis intervention, and a use of force situation, and you're still meeting that mandate. So I think utilizing the training mandates and kind of checking off two or three different boxes that are scenario-based that's mandated annually in Illinois is a great way to do that. Whether force is recommended or not recommended, that's part of it, is de-escalation and picking up some of those cues. So you can build out the training, meeting your mandates, but also incorporating different aspects of things that you want to cover into one scenario-based training. And that's, in Illinois, it's mandated that there has to be some scenario-based training annually, specifically in use of force. Active shooter is another one of those. So it's getting creative on how to build your scenarios and utilizing different strategies that you're training with to kind of hone those skills a little bit. But I always tell law enforcement agencies, and yes, we want to be in tune to the characteristics and things we're going to do, but part of one of the things I really wanted to build in my own department, and then I push to law enforcement agencies, is building an autism outreach program prior to a call for service, prior to a crisis call. Because if you're going there in a crisis, you're dealing with 12 different things, right? You don't know what the antecedent behavior is, the cause of the problem.
Right.
So I said, part of that is getting to know your special needs community prior to a crisis cover call. And we do parent training. I tell them the same thing. I'm like, take the opportunity to expose your loved ones to your first responders, your police, your fire, your EMS. So there is a comfort level prior to a crisis. This is one of the things I really, really pushed in my own department. And even in the department, the area where I live in, I wanted my boys to understand that, number one, law enforcement was there to help, but number two, that to the officers, like, these are my boys' characteristics. Here's some things you can expect. You can see these things ahead of time prior to it. And my boys felt very comfortable, but we're exposed to it because I, you know, seeing a uniform was never a trigger for them because I was just, that was my 20-year career. But a lot of that relationship building starts prior to a crisis call. Having special needs events where your officers, first responders get to interact with your officers and those first responders in a non-crisis type situation. So one of the things that we did is I coach an adaptive soccer program for kids with disabilities. And it's really an awesome story how I got connected with this group is my chief at the time received an email from a concerned parent, you know, some with autism, and he reached out to our department and said, listen, I have some concerns. If I had to call your department, persistence with my son, would your officers understand my son's disability? And I was very, very lucky. And I knew this individual's son because he was one of my students as a school resource officer. So I knew him very, very well. But he is nonverbal. Well, I shouldn't say that he's not nonverbal, but he's very limited verbal ability. And a lot of the responses you'll get are just an affirmative response. He'll just say yes to everything. But he's now bigger than his dad. And he's now 21 years old. So I really pulled at it. I really felt this father's concerns. I did. So I reached out to him. He ran this adaptive soccer program in the town that I worked in. And I met with his family, just talked about some of the things that we were doing in my department. And I fell in love with the program. My boys are registered, and I've been coaching with him for about 7 years. Fantastic. The same organization. He's now kind of stepping away, and I've taken over the program. But what we used to do is we host a first responder game every year. So we had our officers and our firefighters paired up with our kids, because we have all of our players assigned buddies to help facilitate play. Hmm. So we paired up our first responders with our kids. And we had a wide range of disabilities. And it's a way for the officers to interact and see some of the characteristics of the disabilities in a very neutral setting, because our kids were very comfortable with soccer. But they were also very used to having a new buddy every single week. So it wasn't uncommon to have somebody new. And it was a way for our families to get to know our officers and our firefighters. And on the flip side, our firefighters and officers get to know our kids that lived in our community with their disabilities. And building that relationship prior to a crisis, it was awesome.
Yeah.
I actually teach part of the police academy for part-time officers in up here in Northern Illinois. And we've actually built this exact thing into our curriculum. So I teach interacting with people with disabilities, but part of that is a practical setting. So I'm like, what better place? I said, come on out. We're going to pair with my kids during soccer. And I pair these soon-to-be officers with our kids the same way we did it. And we talk about the disabilities, characteristics. We pair them up with the kids. And I still have officers that did this in the academy that still want to come back and volunteer afterwards. So it was very impactful. So those are some of the things that departments can do, but departments should be proactive prior to a crisis call. Because if you're going there just in a crisis in the moment, you're already kind of behind the eight ball per se, that right. You don't know what you're interacting with. But if you have a relationship or understand those characteristics, you know much, much more and how what may work and may not work with that individual and that family.
Yeah. And I love that so much, getting to know your community, basically, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Not just your people with disabilities, but your whole community, you know, and having these kind of events. And so my mind is spinning, thinking, okay, how can I do something like this in my area? I mean, we already have our, I think we have, what's it called? Fire Protection Week or something, where a lot of the local fire departments go to the schools and they'll do, you know, they'll come in their full gear. And most, I mean, there's a good portion of the students whose parents are the volunteer firefighters. And so, you know, they're like, oh, hey, it's dad and it's uncle so-and-so and it's my dad's buddy so-and-so or my mom's friend or whatever, or my mom. And so, you know, we already have that, but I don't know if we have anything where the law enforcement people come in and, you know, do any direct interaction with the students. And where I'm at, it's really rural. We have very small schools, a couple hundred, you know, to maybe 1,000, depending on how many grades are in the school. And so the communities are small. And I'm wondering how I can make something like that, or how I can work with other people to make something like that, where the police officers come in, or, I mean, where we are, most of our firefighters are volunteers, so police officers are paid, but, you know, just finding something where both groups can be together, you know, in their uniforms, because I think that's so important. And so another question that I had for you, I kind of talked about this before, was when we're talking about, you know, most of what we've talked about so far has been the verbal interaction, and, you know, this setting the tone for the situation as much as possible. Do you teach something different specifically for the people that may have a disability, or specifically if the police officer thinks the person has autism, as far as if it does have to get to a physical confrontation?
I do. And a big part of what I cover is just that, going hands-on. There's a couple of videos that I do utilize, but I always tell law enforcement, if you're aware that the individual has a disability, specifically autism, just remember that there's that sensitivity to touch. And because of that, you may trigger a flight or freeze response with them, depending on the individual. So I always tell law enforcement, if you contain them geographically, meaning they're in a safe environment, they're not a harm to themselves or others, refrain from going hands-on, right? Use different strategies. Does every situation dictate that? Absolutely not. It doesn't. And sometimes you just don't have a choice. And I've been in situations with somebody with a disability where we had to go hands-on because it was a safety issue for that individual, not so much the officers, but they're that individual. So I always tell them, like, if you can detain them geographically, wonderful, right? Create a perimeter, create a safe area, use different strategies to de-escalate before going hands-on, because going hands-on could potentially escalate your situation significantly worse. I'll tell you, with my middle son, going hands-on with him, you're pouring gasoline on a fire. And I know that reaction. In some instances, there's just no way around it. But if I just back off and give space, a lot of times he uses his own coping skills to de-escalate himself. And that's what we want to do. One of the other use of force things I talk about is that some individuals with a disability, specifically autism, Down syndrome, are hypotonic, meaning they have those underdeveloped trunk muscles. Mm-hmm. So putting them face down, and for the law enforcement individuals in the, are familiar with positional asphyxia, but positional asphyxia will set in significantly faster with somebody with a disability because they cannot support their own body weight. So if you put them in handcuffs face down and they're already escalated, it's difficulty breathing and they actually suffocate under their own body weight. So I tell officers, I'm like, get them face up as quickly as you possibly can, roll them on their side, stand them up. If you can get them in the back of a car and contain them a little bit, it's a safer place for them to be and allow them to de-escalate. The case I talked about specifically when we first started, that is an example of a positional asphyxia case. 9 minutes face down in handcuffs. He's a larger individual, a larger 16-year-old boy who cannot support his own body weight. And he actually goes into cardiac arrest because of it. Mm-hmm. For my oldest son, his trunk muscles are very weak. And even as a child, so we did years of occupational therapy to build up that core strength. But as he's growing and now a freshman in high school, we were seeing that development in those core muscles is not there again. We had to get him back into physical and OT because to build up those trunk muscles. So I talk about those use of force situations. I also talk about, like, if you're using a taser or pepper spray and taking in the need of those sensory needs, because pain compliance may or may not be effective. Because they feel and experience pain differently. They may feel no pain. They may be overreactive to pain. It depends on the individual. So pain compliance may or may not be effective. And I always tell officers, I'm like, what do we use to gain compliance when we can't gain compliance? And I'm like, we use force. So we use pain. And if it doesn't work, what do? I'm like, we get more pain. It's just the way we kind of do things, right? But in these situations, that's not going to be effective. You're just going to, and I tell officers, I'm like, they escalate, we escalate. They escalate, we escalate. And now the situation has gone really out of hand because we haven't slowed things down. And we haven't stopped and thought about, like, maybe this isn't effective. Let's transition to something else. So being able to shift on the fly a little bit during these situations is really, really critical. And I tell officers, I'm like, I'm not saying you can't use force against someone with a disability. You may have no choice but to.
Right.
But I said, these are the things you're going to experience if you do use force, and just be prepared for that. I said, even if you're using a baton or you're anything like that, I said that those underdeveloped muscles, I said it really can open up to injuries because their muscle development is not the same. So I said these are all things to take into consideration when you use force. And I said you may trigger a fight, flight, or freeze response with this as well. So just be cautious. That's why I always tell officers, I'm like, if you can contain them geographically, great. Like, that is your first and foremost thing. And again, if they're not a threat to themselves or you or someone else, give that distance and keep them in a contained area and use different strategies to de-escalate the situation if you can.
So something else you mentioned earlier was that you were training dispatchers now. So we've been talking about police officers, you know, they're able to be present with the person and see some of the physical aspects that we've talked about, you know, the stimming, maybe even understanding the echolalia a little bit more, you know, in person. It might register better in person, maybe not, maybe it'll register better on the phone. I'm not sure, but what is it that you do with the dispatchers? What are you training them to look for, or listen for, or to say?
So there's a couple of different things I tell dispatchers when I train dispatchers, because really they can be your best source of information. My background is my wife and I met, she was my dispatcher.
Okay.
That's where we met. And she spent 19 years in law enforcement on a civilian side, dispatcher and records. And then when my boys were diagnosed, transitioned into an educator. My wife was actually a third grade teacher special educator as well. So I just transitioned, but having that dispatch background in my in our family, I really took some cues from her of how to be able to handle these interactions. So I told dispatchers, I'm like, listen for key things, especially in the voice. Listen for scripting, echolalia, the deficits in tone of voice that may give you those early indicators that the individual calling has a disability, right? And picking up on some of those cues. But the other thing is, I told families, I'm like, when you call your first responders, make it very clear that your loved one has a disability so they know and can be, that information can be sent out to the officers. So I tell the dispatchers that the minute you hear or the call on the phone says, my loved one has a disability or they have a disability, some certain things to ask and get information to relate to the officers. Well, they are they verbal or nonverbal? If they have de-escalation strategies, what could they possibly be? You know, when in a wandering elopement event, ask, what's their favorite places? What was their change in routine? Had anything changed that will help you when started this search? These are all things we're teaching dispatchers because they're your best source of information. So right. Picking up on some of those cues. So questions to ask if somebody's calling about a loved one with a disability, but also picking up on cues that the person calling has a disability. It's twofold and picking up on our dispatchers. They call them dispatcher ears, and our dispatchers are very keen at picking up on cues, probably better than the officers, because we're relying visually, where our dispatchers are picking up on the auditory differences. With
right.
Them. They're great about it. I always call them my wife's dispatcher ears, where she could pick things up that you miss visually, but she could pick up in tones of voice and things like that. So our dispatchers are great. But another thing that Illinois has, and a lot of states are starting to do it, and I know there are some parents that are apprehensive about it, but it's what it is called a premise alert program. And in Illinois, it's you're pre-registering your loved one with a disability. What happens is the dispatchers type in an address, a name, an alert would come up. There's a premise alert. This individual has autism, has a disability, whatever it might be. Then information can be relayed to the officers. It is a law here in Illinois that departments have to have a premise alert program, whether it's run through the department or their dispatch center. Either one is getting that information to the officers. Again, knowledge is power. And if we know what we're interacting with, we have some of those strategies ahead of the time, that's great. That's wonderful. And that's what we want to do. But for our premise alert program, my department, we took it a step further. We wanted the officers to have access to that information on a call for service. So we actually built that information into an app where the officers could access it on a call for service from a phone or anything that had internet connection with the app. And they can easily look up really quick what strategies would work. So it would be de-escalation, preferred forms of communication, certain things that the officers could access immediately on a scene. Again, providing information for them as well. So it plays right into the dispatcher role as that premise alert is relaying it out, but then the officer can actually access that same information that the dispatcher is seeing in that premise alert and utilize it on a call for service immediately on scene. So our dispatchers are a great form of it, but even like on wandering elopement events, I spend a significant portion of time on this with my training is as a dispatcher, understanding your community, where your bodies of water are, things like that, because you can deploy your resources out to those areas ahead of time. But it's also calling for mutual aid from your surrounding departments, especially in Southern Illinois, where you may only have one or two officers for the county working, right? Where are you calling your mutual aid at for assistance? Are you calling your volunteer fire department? And anybody else that can come out and assist? And immediately mobilizing those resources. I would rather have a huge response and be like, we found that individual, we'll back off, then right. Being an hour or two behind, and now you're trying to play catch up, and you're never going to be able to play the catch up game right. With it. So telling dispatchers, especially in wanting elopement events, critical questions to ask, but also starting to deploy resources out that you have, and knowing those resources prior to the event. Because I'll ask a dispatcher, you know, if you had to call out a bloodhound team, what's your closest bloodhound team? And they're like, I don't know. Right? What jurisdiction has a drone that you can utilize close? I don't know. Right? Who can immobilize whatever it might be, like a dive team or a water rescue team? Who can deploy that out? I don't know. Like, these are things to think about prior to the event ever occurring.
Yeah.
So our dispatchers, I tell them that, and they're like, makes total sense. Makes total sense.
It does. But until you have someone sometimes from the outside ask those kinds of questions, you don't think about them. Because it's not your norm, so it isn't something that you think about like, oh yeah, I need to know this. Now where I am, we do have an extremely large body of water. It's the largest body of water in Illinois, man-made at least, the Carlisle Lake. Okay. I presume, but I don't know, that we have a dive team somewhere accessible to us.
Right.
Not sure. I'm not in law enforcement, but yeah, I mean, those are very excellent questions because as you said, I mean, I'm thinking like our county, we have more than two officers, but like each individual little town within our counties, they may only have one or two officers. Mm-hmm. And I mean, most towns have ponds or, you know, pools that maybe are accessible, even though we think they're not, or, you know, something, you know, wooded areas. We have lots and lots of wooded areas, right. You know, and so, yeah, having drones or having that sort of knowledge of where that stuff can be found. Absolutely. So I want to go back to the app because that seems amazing to me. So is that just that you have developed it for your department, or is it something that any police department could find and access, or help me out with this?
Yeah. So for our records management system, for our policies, things like officer training, we use an application called Power DMS. What Power DMS was really designed for online policy resources, training, things like that. But Power DMS had an app, but there was a little unknown kind of area of Power DMS where you could kind of create things for your department and access from the app. So floor plans for schools or your major businesses. So I'm like, we had a couple instances where the premise alert wasn't relayed to the officers and they didn't have the information. And I'm like, we have to find a better way to do this. So right. We kind of utilized Power DMS and we included it in the app. So it was an app that was included with that, but we just included all of our premise alert programs in there. And a great example is we had just started implementing the information on the application. And we had a young man with autism who wandered off from his house. But we found him in one of our local grocery stores. He was 13. Completely nonverbal, and it was actually the school district that brought him to our attention, to me specifically, because I had a relationship with the schools because I spent some time there. The officers respond there, and he's in his underwear in the middle of his grocery store, but he can't communicate, and he's now agitated because it's sensory overload and all those other things. And I'm like,
right.
Number one, how do we identify him? And number two, how do we de-escalate him? So they're like, wait a minute, we had this app. We pulled him, and I had just registered him like 3 weeks prior. Wow. With his family, got him registered, and they're like, oh, this is him. So they call the mom, and she's like, I sent him to go change, and he bolted. And this was a very common thing that summer with him. We had him, like, I think 6 or 7 times where he did this. But they were able to identify him, reunite him, and de-escalate him all by that app, which could have taken us hours prior to.
Sure.
We were able to work through all this stuff immediately because they had information. So that's how we did it. There's lots of different things out there. We use Power DMS. Power DMS is like, we had never designed our application to be like this, but we think it's awesome that you utilized it. And Power DMS was like grateful and really pushed it out saying, departments, you can follow this suit and utilize it. That's how we did it. Departments can be, some people went as simple as they had access to a Google spreadsheet with photos. Anywhere you can get that information is wonderful.
Right.
However you do it, there's no right or wrong answer. As long as the officers have the ability to access that information on a call for service, it's wonderful. So how do you do it? That's how we did it. But some departments, you know, may have another resource that I don't know about that I haven't seen.
Sure.
But that's what we did.
Okay.
So it was a tremendous resource. And we used it multiple times. It wasn't just that one instance. We had several instances where had we not had the information in our hands, it would have made the call for service that much more difficult.
Yeah. And that's incredible. And I'm hoping that, you know, many places around the country are utilizing something like that, if not all districts around the country. And I mean, even in my small district, when I drive around, and St. Louis, Missouri is nearby. And so we're in the city often. And, you know, when I've seen police cars there, too, most of the cars have a computer in them. Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, they're not sitting back at the office waiting for a call and then they're going out. So it's not like, you know, they could access files, hard copy files anyway. They have to have something digitally. And so that just sounds like an amazing way to utilize a resource you already had and like you said, it just that information is so powerful. And the more of it we have, usually the better off we are.
Yes. I tell parents, like a lot of parents are very apprehensive about a special needs registry or a PremiSLR program because they feel their loved one will be targeted. But I will tell you this, information is critical. And if we know what we're kind of responding to prior to, like, we can change those tactics and use these other strategies because we're taking the guesswork out, right? The biggest thing with law enforcement is, I kind of said it prior, is we don't know what we're walking into. And we have the ability to make split-second decisions. But if we have that information prior to arrival or on scene, utilizing information, guess what? We don't have to react in split seconds. We have more information. We can formulate plans better because we know what we're interacting with. I said no law enforcement agency is going to target someone with a disability because they're quote-unquote pre-registered. I will tell you, in my jurisdiction where I live, both of my boys are registered. I'm a huge advocate for it, a firm believer in it, and it's a great way for parents. And if you're apprehensive about it, go meet with your first responding agency. Go meet with your police department. I want to know about your PremiSLR program, who has access to it, and what information does it include. If you don't feel comfortable then, I understand it. But if you do, like, now is your chance to be able to do that. My jurisdiction where I live actually issued out bracelets, numbered bracelets. So if they were nonverbal, they could identify the individual by the number of bracelet. My boys won't wear them. Right. They won't wear them. But another good thing we utilize too is MediClerk has a program called LEAP. It's Law Enforcement Agency Portal. And it was grant funded by the Department of Justice, but also through the Alzheimer's Association and Autism Society of America. And what they did is they offered a free program to law enforcement. They created a database, a web-based database, where you can pre-register your special needs citizens. And once they're registered, MediClerk would issue them out an individualized serial number bracelet. But they also did it as shoe tags as well. Because my kids won't wear the bracelet, but they would put it on their shoes. And you could identify that individual from that ID number. There's a bunch of things out there. I connected with another group. I'm trying to remember what it was called. But they used QR codes with shoe tags. And you could scan a QR code and had all their demographic information with it. I tell officers, like, you may respond to a wandering elopement event. It will probably happen. But I said, I will tell you, most times you're finding somebody that hasn't been reported yet who can't communicate. So I said, in those situations, how are you identifying that individual? And what resources do you have to be able to do that in a quick amount of time? And these are just some of the things that we push out program-wise. And I tell agencies, I'm like, you utilize what works for your department, but here are a wide array of resources that you can incorporate what works for your department. There's lots of things out there, but sometimes you just don't know where to look. So,
right. That's fantastic. I'm so thankful for all that you are doing and all the information that you've shared so far. I do have your website up on the screen now. It's www.bluelinespectrumsafety.com. Is that the best way to get a hold of you if there is a department head watching and they want you to come in and or they want more information about you?
Yes, that's the best way. You can reach out to me through the website. My email address is on there. My phone number is on there. That is my phone number. So it will go right to me. I'm the only one that will answer it. So if you have questions, concerns, for our law enforcement agencies here in Illinois, it took me a long time, but my class that I run now is ILETSB certified. So Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board. So any department looking for that training can get that ILETSB credit to meet those training mandates that we get. I'm certified in just about every mobile training unit in the state, all the way from Southern Illinois, all the way up here to Northern Illinois. So I know it's a big thing that department heads and chiefs are looking for is, can my officers get the training mandate credits? And the answer is yes, you can. And my class covers CIT, procedural justice, use of force, a couple different mandates that are needed. So I know that's a big aspect of trying to get that in. But yes, my class now is, and I'm actually working to get nationally accredited as well. There's another organization that will actually certify your class. And I think it's 42 out of 50 states accept it across the country.
Oh, wow.
So that they can get those post credits from training mandates to meet that mandate. So it's a huge aspect of it. And it's been a very tedious process, but it's one of those ones that we wanted to get. And they really dictate your curriculum and how you do certain things as well. So having those certifications we know that the curriculum is a vetted curriculum that's been trained across the country and vetted by some of our subject matter experts, especially in Illinois. And the individual who certified my class, I actually teach with now. So, I mean, I know, he's like, I know you were good and the class was certified. So I've been teaching with him for many, many years. But so for our Illinois agencies, yes, you can get ILSB credit. And that's a big question that I get a lot from department heads.
Yeah. So it's
a very big aspect of that.
And I know, as I said earlier, you know, I'm trying to work on getting you down to my area to do the training. And when I talked to the local police officers, I said, you know, maybe my company, Shelley Kino IEP Consultant, can help offset some of the costs. And he said, well, actually, we have this grant or that grant. I don't know the name of it. But so I think, you know, there might be ways too that to help offset the cost of it. And do you recommend that your training be in person or can you do it virtually?
I can do it virtually, but I'd rather be in person. It's much more impactful via in-person training. And I would always rather have people in the seats,
right,
as my position with it. I know cost is a thing too in having that, but there is a not-for-profit that I do work with up here in Northern Illinois. They're based out of Elgin, called the Autism Hero Project. And their background is really they're helping families get grant funding for critical therapies, so ABA, speech, occupational therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But they've really branched out into that law enforcement end, and they secured a grant as well with some money. So if there's a department looking cost-wise to offset, those grants are available. I do have an organization that I do work with that is grant-funded that will cover the cost or a significant portion of the cost for an agency to get trained. So I know cost is a big thing, so having the offer from you, from your company as well, would be a wonderful thing. And, you know, I don't want cost to be a hindrance. That's the biggest thing. Like, I get it. Things cost money. But if we can get the training out and we can have organizations that will offset the cost to get the training in, it's wonderful. And if I come down there, I'm happy to do six agencies if they'll get me through. Like, there is no cap on an individual on a class size. If I can get 200 in a class, I've done training in Tennessee for 400 officers. We'll make it work. I would love to get, you know, several agencies involved, even an entire county if we could, to do a host of training, especially for officers in Southern Illinois. I know the training's not the same down in Southern Illinois that is up in Northern Illinois. So.
Right. Yeah. Cause our population is not as dense as what it is in Northern Illinois, but that doesn't mean that we don't have people with disabilities. So,
exactly. You
know, and obviously people with disabilities are my passion. So I, of course, want to make sure that population is covered as much as possible. And so just as a side note that if, you know, anyone is listening and I'm not in your area, you may try to, you know, if you're wanting Stefan to come in, that you reach out to your school or maybe a local university who has a special ed teaching program or some other agency that's helping people with disabilities to partner with you, that may be able to help offset the cost a little bit, because I think this is so incredibly important. And and reach out to me and you know, I'll work with Stefan, and if my company, Shelley Kino IEP Consultant, can help in some way, you know, I'm happy to consider that, because that's how important this is to me. You know, I have lots of family in law enforcement and emergency response teams. And, obviously again, my passion being people with disabilities. So I want to get these communities meshing together in a beautiful way, to have the best outcomes possible whenever situations arise. So, we are needing to wrap up. I think I could talk to you for hours more, just learning more about this, but I really try to keep this at an hour or less, and we're right at that point. So is there anything, any other information that you want to share, any other way that people can get a hold of you or that you would recommend that they, how can they help their community?
No, I think I'll switch gears a little bit from a parent perspective though. If your local department is not getting training, put the pressure on them. Go to the chief or the sheriff or whoever it is and saying, listen, as a parent of a loved one with special needs, this is critical. You have to get some form of training. We don't want a misinterpretation of characteristics or a negative interaction with my loved one. No chief's going to say, you know what, I don't really want to do that. Right? They're not going to. But as parents, be advocates. Be a tremendous advocate. And teach parent groups, I'm like, you're your loved one's best advocate. Be that voice, be that that push that helps people address the needs that you have for your loved one. So I, as a parent, from a parent's perspective, I went to my local jurisdiction and said, listen, I run this training. I will come in and do it. And they're like, yeah, absolutely. And I went and did it at no cost for them. But my, at that point I was still working. My department's like, go train them. And they did it on my, I did it on my work schedule there. That's how important my department felt and how passionate my department was about it. So, but I reached out to my local jurisdiction. I said, I run this training. I said, I'll happily come in. And they're like, yeah, absolutely. And this is what our departments did. And I will tell you from another perspective and a personal perspective, like I had to switch gears and I had to call them for assistance with one of my sons. And I felt confident knowing that the department responded, that the two, three departments that responded had all been trained. Two of the three I had trained, and their response was textbook. Awesome. So it's very impactful. And as that was always my motivations, like the roles had switched. I had to call my local jurisdiction for assistance with one of my sons during at an elopement event, actually, is what it was. And they did great. Their response was textbook. Like they did a phenomenal job. And I think it was 11 minutes from 911 call to recovery. I mean, that's how fast they moved. And he was 2.5 miles from home.
Wow.
He was gone 2 hours. He did it in the middle of the night. So the training is effective. It works. Departments are receptive to it. Again, departments want to do the right thing. So giving them those resources, and tools and training is available to make the right decisions is a wonderful thing. So, as parents, push your jurisdictions, push your agencies to get the training, whether it's for me or somebody else, doesn't matter. But, as long as the training gets out there, it's important. But from a parent's perspective, be an advocate for your loved ones.
So, yeah.
Same thing with schools as well. Be an advocate. We could go on a whole different rabbit hole with IEPs, and I know that's your background, but
right.
Oh boy, look, be an advocate for your kids in your IEP meetings. Like I said, when we first went in, we were snowballed so bad in the beginning, and now we're like, we've done it so many times. We're like, we know how this process is going to work, but nobody explained it to us when our kids were 3 and 4 in early childhood. Now that they're in junior high and high school, they're like, they give us an extra hour for IEP because they know we're going to ask the questions and be those advocates. But in the beginning, like for our parents who are just getting a diagnosis or going through the IEP process, like, again, you don't know what you don't know. And it's the school districts are not going to tell you, like, find an IEP advocate and get training and be well-versed in it. From a parent's perspective, please do. In the long run, it will benefit your loved one moving through that program and be that voice and be an advocate for your kids. So,
absolutely. Well, thanks for that plug, even though that wasn't intended. But
no, but I got to remember I'm a parent too, and like my wife is an educator now, so now we're like she's got a special endorsement, so now we know. But like in the beginning, it was like we walked out of there with our head spinning. So like, please get that if you can get any resources regarding your EEP, like IEPs, and do it. And you hear terms like BIP and FBA and IEPs and all these things, and you don't know what it is, and you get snowballed like. Go and prepare it. And if you don't know, find that advocate or somebody who are great IEP resources, tremendous to be that advocate. So,
yeah, I love what I do. And I'm so happy that I can help. And I work with families and school districts because some school districts don't understand everything that they can do either. And, you know, we could have a whole nother show about just that.
Maybe we will.
But Stefan, again, thank you so much for being here and all the great information that you shared. I wish you amazing success in training all police officers across the country, because it's so vitally important. And to everyone who joined in live today or is watching in the replay, thank you so much. Be sure to share this with your local law enforcement officers or your family members who are law enforcement officers so that what Stefan is doing is getting out there, because, you know, we all that ripple effect. And so the more you share this, the more the algorithm is going to pick it up and say more people need to see this. And the more likely we're going to be able to help the majority of a larger number of people, not the majority of people, but a larger number of people. And that's what Stefan and I are here to do. I'm here to help broaden everybody's perspectives, to see people with their abilities differently, and to help as much as possible. And Stefan does the same thing, but with law enforcement specifically, and your emergency responders specifically. So it's a beautiful thing that you're doing. I can't express my gratitude enough. It really touches my heart what you're doing, and it gives me great hope for the future of our people with disabilities and their interactions with emergency response crews. Because we never know when we're going to have that interaction, whether we're disabled or not. And so it's always important to have good training, and the more training and the better the training, better for everybody. So thank you again. And I will see you all next week.
Great. Thank you, Shelley. It was a great pleasure to be on with you today. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.